Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Nartrees Podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It is a 1914 collection of public policy essays by lawyer and future Supreme Court Justice Louis D. Brandeis. Written during the Progressive Era and first published in Harper's Weekly, it examines the power of investment bankers over American industry, transport, insurance, and savings institutions. Brandeis argues that a small financial elite could turn dispersed public savings into a tool for private control. His concern is not banking in the ordinary sense of lending, but the combination of underwriting, corporate directorships, stock ownership, and influence over credit. That combination, he contends, enabled financiers to shape corporate decisions while avoiding the discipline of genuine competition. The book blends financial explanation, antitrust advocacy, legal reasoning, and moral criticism. It draws particular force from the Pujo Committee investigation into the Money Trust, while presenting its evidence for a broad readership. Its central purpose is to show why concentrated financial power is a civic problem, not merely a technical matter for specialists. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, public savings become the raw material of financial control. Brandeis begins from a basic but consequential fact: investment bankers did not rely only on their own capital. They operated amid large pools of deposits, insurance reserves, and investor funds that ultimately belonged to ordinary savers and policyholders. The title identifies the ethical and institutional issue. When financial intermediaries deploy other people's money, their discretion can affect enterprises far beyond the immediate transaction. In Brandeis's account, access to this money gave leading banking houses unusual leverage over the issuance and distribution of corporate securities. A firm seeking capital could become dependent on the bankers who organized its financing, found buyers, and maintained market support for its securities. The result was influence over management as well as finance. Brandeis does not treat all financial intermediation as improper. His criticism targets the conversion of entrusted funds into a durable private power system. The public bore much of the underlying risk, while a narrow group could secure fees, privileged information, and strategic control. This argument connects fiduciary responsibility with market structure. It asks readers to evaluate finance, not only by whether transactions are lawful or profitable, but also by who exercises discretion, whose interests are represented, and whether the resulting allocation of capital remains accountable to the public. Secondly, interlocking directorates blur the line between advisor and interested party. A central mechanism in the book is the interlocking directorate, the overlapping presence of bankers and their associates on the boards of banks, railroads, industrial companies, public service firms, and insurance institutions. Brandeis argues that these connections created conflicts that could not be solved merely by assuming good intentions. A banker who helps decide that a corporation should issue securities, then underwrites or sells those securities, occupies roles with potentially opposed interests. The corporation needs financing on fair terms, while the underwriter can benefit from favorable pricing, commissions, or control of the deal. Board overlap also widened the practical reach of major banking houses. Its applied inside knowledge, access to corporate decisions, and continuing influence after a financing transaction ended. Brandeis uses this structure to challenge the claim that dispersed corporations were independently managed. Formal legal separation could coexist with coordinated practical control when the same people, partners, or close associates appeared across governing boards. His analysis is significant because it focuses on incentives and institutional design rather than individual scandal alone. Even honest participants could be placed in positions where loyalty was divided. The proposed remedy, therefore, points towards separating incompatible functions and increasing visibility into relationships. For Brandeis, competition requires independent judgment by corporate managers, lenders, and investors, not simply a large number of separately incorporated entities. Thirdly, the Money Trust operates through coordination rather than one visible monopoly. Brandeis uses the term Money Trust to describe a system of concentrated financial influence, not simply a single legal trust or one bank with an exclusive charter. This distinction is crucial to his argument. Economic power could be consolidated through alliances, recurring underwriting arrangements, shared directors, and control over access to capital, even when firms remained nominally separate. He argues that this network made it easier to organize large industrial combinations and harder for independent businesses to obtain comparable financial support. The issue, then, was not only the size of a corporation after it had merged. It was the financial process that helped produce and preserve consolidation. Brandeis regards the concentration of credit as especially potent because credit is an essential input for expansion, reorganization, and survival during difficult conditions. A new or smaller competitor may have a better product or business model, yet still fail if it cannot obtain capital on reasonable terms. Meanwhile, established combinations could benefit from trusted relationships with dominant financiers. This analysis broadens antitrust thinking beyond prices and overt agreements. It examines the gatekeepers who determine which enterprises can scale and which securities reach investors. Brandeis thereby links financial architecture to industrial structure. His concern is that private coordination can suppress the open field in which independent producers, innovators, and smaller firms would otherwise compete. Fourthly, bigness is criticized as an organizational and democratic problem. The book is often associated with Brandeis's skepticism toward bigness, but his position is more specific than a simple objection to large-scale enterprise. He argues that great size can generate inefficiency, obscure responsibility, and place decisions too far from the people affected by them. Large combinations may claim superior organization, yet Brandeis questions whether centralized financial and industrial control actually produces sound management. When authority is concentrated in a small circle of financiers and directors, owners, workers, consumers, and local businesses can have little practical voice. Information may also become less reliable, as decisions move through complex corporate hierarchies and depend on interested intermediaries. Brandeis connects these organizational concerns to political liberty. Economic power can shape public policy, public opinion, and opportunities for participation without requiring formal governmental office. His democratic objection is therefore institutional. A republic is strained when a few private actors command resources on a scale that gives them exceptional influence over national economic life. This does not make the book a rejection of markets. Brandeis defends competitive opportunity and productive enterprise against arrangements that insulate dominant firms from rivalry. His standard is whether the economy offers a fair field for initiative, rather than special advantages created by financial privilege. The argument remains historically situated, but it clearly distinguishes productive scale from concentrated control that is difficult to scrutinize or challenge. Lastly, publicity and structural reform are Brandeis's answer to hidden power. Brandeis's critique is not limited to exposing abuses. He repeatedly emphasizes publicity, meaning meaningful disclosure of relationships, profits, and conflicts that are otherwise difficult for investors and citizens to see. Disclosure matters because financial power often works through complicated arrangements rather than conspicuous commands. If a banker, director, and security seller have intertwined interests, the affected corporation and its investors need enough information to judge whether the transaction is fair. Brandeis also argues that transparency alone cannot cure every conflict. Where functions are fundamentally incompatible, institutional separation is preferable to relying on private restraint. His discussion of interlocking directorates illustrates this structural approach. The aim is to prevent a person or group from serving masters whose interests diverge, rather than waiting to punish misconduct after losses occur. These proposals fit the wider progressive era effort to make corporate power more answerable through law, investigation, and administrative oversight. Brandeis supports his case with financial figures and material associated with the Peugeot Committee, using evidence to make a technical subject intelligible as a public issue. The book does not offer a complete blueprint for a new financial system, and its specific examples belong to its period. Still, its reform logic is clear: reveal hidden arrangements, reduce divided loyalties, and preserve conditions in which capital serves enterprise and the public rather than an entrenched financial oligarchy. In conclusion, Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It is best suited to readers interested in antitrust, banking history, corporate governance, progressive era reform, or the relationship between economic and political power. Lawyers, policy students, historians, and financially literate general readers will find its institutional questions especially useful. The practical benefit is not a set of current investment instructions. Rather, the book teaches readers to look behind corporate labels and financial transactions: who controls credit, who sits in overlapping decision-making roles, who bears risk, and who receives the benefits of access and information. Those questions remain valuable when assessing modern debates about concentration, conflicts of interest, and financial regulation. Readers should expect dated examples, a polemical reform voice, and substantial attention to early 20th century railroads, insurance companies, and banking houses. Brandeis also provides stronger diagnosis than a fully detailed modern policy program. Yet these limits are part of its value as a historical intervention. Unlike many general critiques of monopoly, the book traces industrial concentration back to the financial arrangements that enable it. Unlike narrowly technical banking texts, it explains those arrangements as matters of democratic accountability and fair competition. Its combination of concrete institutional analysis, legal sensibility, and public moral argument makes it distinctive. The book remains an important foundational statement of the idea that financial structure is not neutral. It can distribute opportunity, shape corporate behavior, and influence the practical health of a democratic economy. If you would like to support Louis Brandeis, You can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.